I'd like to cover an area that we don't normally think about. And that is to ask the question, what exactly is Christianity anyway? We know how it's defined in this day and age, and we kind of look at church history that has been brought through a process that brings us to where we are today. But what was it like in the first century? There's that story that we've heard from many, many sources, including our own, it was like there was a curtain drawn over church history that covered the first century. It wasn't until after the first century had ended that that curtain was drawn away, and we begin to get what we would consider the history, the development of what is known as the Christian church. But what was behind that curtain? That's the question. When we consider the early Christianity, we have to consider a number of important situations. We could call them cultural or religious situations that had an impact on where Christianity first took root in a significant way. And we find that there was a period of time, and it's spoken of often by a number of different denominations, they recognize that there was a period of time where the young Jesus was not present in his native land. And there's speculation as to what happened. It was a period of time of almost a decade and a half where he was absent. There's no mention of him after age 12. And not again until he's about to begin his ministry at age 30. There was a missing period of time. Where was he? And why does it matter? Well, when we understand where he was, we can begin to see it matters a great deal. Because, you see, God had a plan for bringing Christianity through the ages to present it to the world. And the cultural environment in which his ministry began was not really amenable to that development. For example, his own native land, his own people. He came to his own and his own received him not. We know that verse. That was not a good environment to introduce Christianity. It had a lot of opposition, severe opposition. The Apostle Paul explains it in Galatians chapter 1, and we know of this, verses 13 and 14. For you have heard of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion, how that beyond measure I persecuted the church of God and wasted it, and profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in mine own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the tradition of my fathers. Paul is giving us a glimpse into what the religious environment was in his day and how that culture would react to Christ's ministry. You could be killed for professing Christ. Paul himself was involved in that in a very potent way. And he wasn't the only one. We can be sure there were others doing the same thing. We know of Paul because he wrote of it. But history doesn't necessarily preserve what else was going on. But my point is, the cultural environment for the introduction of Christianity Judea was not a good environment. There were individuals who were called, who became converted, yes. But as a cultural environment, that was not a good place. Paul speaks of his own ministry in the next chapter of Galatians. Galatians 2, verses 1 and 2. Then 14 years after, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas and took Titus with me also, and went up by revelations and communicated unto them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to them which were of reputation, lest by any means I should run or had run in vain. What is he saying there? He's saying that even among the Christian leadership in Judea at the time, the cultural reaction to Paul taking God's truth to non-Jews drew a bad reaction. He had to be careful in what he said and who he said it to. So that gives us another glimpse into the cultural and religious environment of that region of the earth. Now, let's turn it back to Jesus Christ. In his late teenage and early 20 years, where did he go? The consensus is, among many, and it certainly is preserved in British history, that he went to England. He went to Britain. Now, I spoke on this a month ago in my message on Joseph of Arimathea, his great uncle, whom he traveled with, who was a frequent visitor to southern England because he was a tin merchant, and that's where he made his fortune. Another message that is somewhat background for this one is when I spoke on the Empire of Parthia, and that was in February and March of 2023. And I have a booklet that explains that understanding. It's called The Divided Kingdom, and you might want to have a copy of that because it's very, very informative as to the religion of Parthia and how it became gradually incorporated into what we know now as the Christian religion. I'll speak of that in a few minutes. But why would he go to Britain? What was there? Well, it turns out that the British Isles was part of God's plan for proclaiming the gospel to the world. It was pre-prepared for what was to come. What was Jesus' interest in going there? That's where the throne of David was. He was to inherit that throne. Let's look at a few verses that talk about that. In Jeremiah 23, verse 5, "Behold, the days come, says the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and he shall execute judgment and justice in the earth." We don't necessarily recognize the full aspect of the full relevance of that until we read other things. In 1 Kings 9, verse 5, "Then I will establish the throne of your kingdom," speaking to David, "upon Israel forever, as I promised to David your father, saying, there shall not fail you a man upon the throne of Israel." Now in Ezekiel 21, there is a rather obscure verse, and we don't necessarily, in reading over these things, recognize the full implication of what it's saying. But in Ezekiel 21, verse 27, he's speaking of this dynasty, the Davidic line. He says, "I will overturn overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him." Do we realize what's that saying, who it's talking about? Now, unfortunately, the King James translation is perhaps gives us a word that is a little misleading in what it's actually saying. It might be more correct to say, instead of overturn, to say transplant. Because the Davidic line was transplanted out of the Judean region to another place. And that transplanting was going to occur three times. I'll make a long story short here and just say that that occurred when it was transplanted from Judea to Ireland, to Scotland, and to England. That was where the line of David was preserved until the present time, when Christ will inherit that throne, the throne of his father David. Now, how did that happen? There was a daughter of the final king of Israel. The king was taken captive by Babylon. He was killed. All of his sons were killed. But a couple of his daughters were under the custody of the prophet Jeremiah and his assistant Baruch. The scriptures speak of that, but we don't necessarily understand the full implication of it. But let me just read this portion, and this is from historical sources. It says, according to the Irish poems and a couple of websites, a daughter named Tiatefi was the beautiful one with a royal, prosperous smile, and the most beautiful that traversed the plain. Supposedly, she was one of King Zedekiah's, of Judah's daughters. Zedekiah was the last of Judah, of the house of David, before the Babylonian invasion by Nebuchadnezzar II in 597 BC. Zedekiah's sons perished, as did he, but somehow his two daughters, Tiatefi and Tamar Tefi, escaped with the prophet Jeremiah. They traveled from Egypt to Spain, through Gibraltar, through southern England, and then ended up in Ireland. According to legend, Tiatefi brought sacred Hebrew relics to the British Isles. She was also responsible for bringing the Stone of Destiny to Britain, which Scottish and English kings used for their coronations. The stone is called Jacob's Pillow. It is supposedly the actual stone on which Jacob slept, and we read of that in Genesis 35:14. King Edward I took it from Scotland to London, and that shows its eventual destination. Tiatefi ended up marrying an Irish king named Hiramon. The royal couple gave birth to four children. The legend states that Tiatefi was, in fact, the progenitor of the British monarchy. So that tells us how the Davidic throne got to where it is today. And that would explain Jesus' interest in going to England as a young man. But there's more to that story. Because, you see, the people in that region were already somewhat prepared for what was to come. There were Hebrew peoples living in the British Isles. For that matter, the whole Western European coast. Places like Iberia. Do people understand where Iberia is? That's Spain. Portugal. The Hebrides, or Hibernia, in northern England. Those are derivatives of the name of Eber. Eber is six generations removed from Abraham's time. He was the man who gave the name to the Hebrew people. So when we say they were Hebrews in that region, we're identifying an ethnicity, not necessarily anything to do with Jewish. Jews don't own the name Hebrew. There are many peoples descended from Eber who are not even Israelites. So it's a broader ethnicity, but the point is they were there long before. And it certainly had a lot to do with the fact that the Davidic throne was transferred there back in the 500-600s BC. I forget exactly how long it was, a long time before. So the crown was there. The people were there. People who would be receptive to Jesus' ministry, more so than you would expect in Judea, or for that matter, in any Roman-dominated area of the earth. Because Rome hated Christians as well. We know that for a fact by what they did. But there was this environment in Judea with the Jewish-type religious system that was hostile to the Christian religion. And we certainly had Rome with the same problem. So if God wanted to plant the Christian religion in an area where it would prosper, wouldn't he pick a place that had what we could call good soil? And that was the situation. It was outside of the areas of Jewish influence. It was outside of the area of Roman influence. It was a perfect environment for what was to come. And then we had the major figure of Joseph of Arimathea, who was exiled from Judea in the about 36 AD. And where did he go? He went to a region that he was already known in, he was already familiar with, because he conducted trade from there, from southern England, back and forth to Rome and the western Mediterranean, eastern Mediterranean. He had connections. Joseph was a man of great wealth. The Romans knew him as a nobilis decorio. And it had been said that it was easier to become a Roman senator than to become a nobilis decorio. But what did that mean? Joseph was a prominent man in the region. Besides being extremely wealthy, and now this is the we're talking about Jesus' great uncle. Besides being wealthy, he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was also a local Roman senator, not from Rome, but from the region. He was well known in Rome, in Judea, and in southern England. And in southern England, he had interactions with the British royalty. So this was a man who had influence. He had power. He had connections. And he traveled to and from southern England year after year after year. And maybe to give him a little picture of who he was and his relative age, he was about, he was born in like 18 BC, which means that when Jesus was 12, he was just something under 30 years old. So he wasn't that much older, even though being a great uncle. But when he was exiled, well, let's back it up. When he was communicating back and forth to southern England, it is reported by many sources, many historical sources, that young Jesus went with him. He was familiar with southern England. And I asked before, what was his interest there? Well, his interest there, number one, was the Davidic line was there, which he would ultimately come to inherit. Not only that, but it was an area that was out from under the influence of persecutions, both by the religious people in Judea and in Rome. Romans had their own religion. If you were a good Roman, you had to worship the emperor. They didn't tolerate other religions. Even the Jews at one time under Claudius was expelled from Rome because of the religious clash. So we need to get the picture. The reason for Jesus' interest in southern England was the fact that it was a good environment for introducing Christianity to that part of the world. Now we can think of the impact or the influence that England had on Christianity throughout time, throughout history. I'm not saying that its religion as it came to be was any more pure than any other, but for the first several hundred years, they got their religion directly from Jesus himself and from the Arimathean mission, Joseph of Arimathea, who lived in that region after he had been exiled, for nearly 40 years. And he was a major evangelist, if you want to say, or apostle, to that part of the world. He even had influence and baptized some of the British royalty. Now, we talked about in the past the Claudian invasion of Britain. Very likely the problem with Britain was not its territory so much as it was its religious influence. Rome wanted to conquer Britain for the purpose of negating that influence. Claudius invaded southern England in 43 AD, and that went on for a period of 9 years until the British royalty had been captured and taken to Rome for a 7-year exile. Those who were taken to Rome were people who knew Joseph of Arimathea, some of whom were baptized by him. For example, Linus, who Paul consecrated as the first bishop of Rome in the British mission, and a fellow called Pudens, and you read of him in 2 Timothy 4, who it turns out was Paul's half-brother. They shared the same mother, different father. Both were baptized. Now Pudens, in his earlier years, before he married the king's daughter, Claudia, Pudens was the aide-de-camp to the invading Roman general, Aulus Plautius. That's how he met that family. That's how he met, turns out, bride-to-be. Paul speaks of all three of those in 2 Timothy 4. But here's the thing. Britain was pre-prepared to receive the gospel. It was pre-prepared by the placement of the Davidic line. It was pre-prepared by at least a major portion of the population being of Hebrew stock. And we need to understand the Jews don't own Hebrewness. there are many, many ethnicities that are of Hebrew or Iberian origin that were not Jews. For that matter, the 10 tribes were just as Hebrew as were the 2 tribes that we know today as Jewish people. So when we say Hebrew, we need to think in a little broader sense. The Jews don't own Hebrewness. That's important to realize. But Britain was prepared. There was a plan for Britain to preserve the Davidic line, to give rise to what we could call primitive Christianity. And what was primitive Christianity? Primitive Christianity was the faith once delivered, that original faith. It did not have most of the elements that we find in what we call Christianity today. That came much later. Christianity in Britain flourished, so much so that after a century, the British king declared Christianity to be the religion of the realm. And that was 200 years before the Catholic Church supposedly introduced Christianity into Britain in 397 AD. Now the story is, and it's what people would say today, that Rome introduced Christianity to Britain when in fact it was quite the other way around. Britain introduced Christianity to Rome in the family that was taken captive from Britain, brought to Rome for a 7-year exile, who were already baptized Christians, some of whom were baptized by Joseph of Arimathea himself. So let's understand that true Christianity, primitive Christianity, original Christianity, uncontaminated Christianity was introduced into the heart of Rome by the British mission, if we could call it that, those who came from Britain under unpleasant circumstances, however, but it was there. It was Britain that introduced Christianity to Rome. Rome had its own process going on in the development of what became the Catholic Church. The idea of the Church as we know it, the Roman Church as we know it, was an ongoing development. It was not from the beginning. It gradually came to be over the centuries. It was clear up until 610 AD when the papacy was installed, was formalized. 600 years, practically. Now, there's the story of the succession of the popes, from the Peter being the first pope. That's its own story. But think about it. This was 600 years later, before they even began to believe that kind of thing. There was a Roman historian called Tacitus. He's thought to be very reputable. And he wrote from about 14 AD through like 68 AD, somewhere in that time frame. His writings were very accurate, very impartial. He had no axe to grind. He had no agenda. He just wrote the history as he understood it. And there's some amazing stuff in his writings. But Tacitus wrote, and he described a lot of these things that we're talking about today. But Britain was prime territory for proclaiming the true original gospel. And that's why Jesus' interest was there. And that's why he spent his young years there, to prepare those people for his message that was to come later on by the Arimathean mission. And that went on for centuries, practically. uncontaminated by the ideas that were developing all around. It was the Augustinian mission that came from Rome into Britain in like 397 AD. But by that time, the Roman Church had developed into much of what it is today. And there were many teachings that they tried to introduce into the environment in Britain at the time, which got a very bad reaction. They were not accepting of papal authority. They were not acceptive of the idea of Mariology and all of that kind of thing. Many, many apostasies had been incorporated into the religion, the Christian religion, in the Roman environment. When they tried to introduce that into Britain, it just didn't go well at all. And they had to enforce it by arms. Many of the religious leaders in Britain in the early 400s AD were martyred. They were killed. They resisted because they knew better. And that was just not going to go with the powers that were developing at the time. There were battles, and many were killed. And eventually, the Roman Church infiltrated the religious belief system in Britain, which we find there to this day. There were many things that were incorporated that were not in the original teachings, such as the idea of the immortal soul. The early church didn't teach that. You don't find it in your New Testament. Heaven and hell. We find that kind of teaching in pagan religions. Where do you find it in the New Testament? That people go to heaven or they go to hell immediately upon death. Do you find that? They had no use for the biblical holy days. They had a different series of holy days that were brought in. Problems about understanding the nature of God. The hierarchical structure. The early church didn't have that. And most obviously, Sunday worship. Those were not found in the early New Testament church. They had to be imposed. And that we could call another fulfillment of what we read in Revelation 12, which I spoke on last week. So that's the situation. Primitive Christianity was nothing like what we see today, and we should recognize that so many things, so many apostate ideas were incorporated into the so-called Christian religion that were not there originally. And it was many centuries before they became infused into it. But there was resistance, and that resistance was based on the fact that so much had been established in Britain long before. But Britain was prepared for what was to come, for what was to be brought to it. Another piece I want to read here, and this is something that I wrote to someone who got back to me on my Arimathean message. But let me read this reply. It says, I'm not sure that we're going to find much from modern sources on such matters. And of course, there's a great effort to obscure many truths, particularly historic truths, particularly the faith as it was originally believed. One of my sources is the book by Jowett called Drama of the Lost Disciples, which provides an excellent narrative on the Arimathean era when Joseph was expelled from Judea in about 36 AD. Much is written in British histories about that. He, of course, was very familiar with the region of southern England where he made his fortune dealing, trading in tin from there. Joseph also had contacts in high places in both southern England and Rome. How is it that the Roman elites wouldn't know where their nobilis decurio had disappeared to? They knew where he was. Modern sources tend to relegate any such information to myth or just ancient legend. They don't want to know. They don't want to know. Particularly the Roman Church, that perpetuates their own myth that it brought Christianity to Britain in the early 400s under the Augustinian mission, where the truth is quite the opposite. That being with the exile to Rome of the royals captured in Britain for a seven-year exile during the mid-50s AD, the British introduced original Christianity to Rome in and after the year 52. We have evidence of that family in Rome in 2 Timothy 4. Caradoc's son, that was the king, Caradoc, his daughter, and his daughter's husband. And that would be a very interesting rabbit trail for those of us who to follow. We also have positive evidence of Caradoc's capture and elite and exile in Rome from Roman historian Tacitus in his Annals 1237. And he wrote from 14 to 68 AD. This is cited in Joseph Jowett's Drama of the Lost Disciples, page 106. The Romans knew him as Caractacus. Caradoc was a royal who headed the British forces opposing the Roman invasion for 9 years, from 43 on. No doubt we would have better affirmations of what is today regarded as mere legends had the library at Glastonbury not burned in the 1100s. Typical of Roman conquest, they burned libraries to sever the conquered from their own history. Sometimes deliberate, sometimes not. But it served the interests to obscure the facts of history. As to the edict itself, we have the invasion as evidence of the intent. We know the players, the military leaders, etc., and the exiles, which Peter and Paul met and interacted with in Rome. Rufus Pudens, the Rufus that Paul addresses, who is Paul's half-brother, by the way. Rufus Pudens was aide-de-camp to the invading Roman general Aulus Plautius. Turns out Rufus was also a Roman senator and half-brother of Paul, and we read of that in Romans 16:13. Rufus was later converted. And he married the daughter of King Caradoc. But all of this is interesting. What does it mean to us? Why would we care? Well, knowing these things helps us understand the true nature and the true origin of the Christian belief system. What we read in the New Testament is nothing like what we find in the so-called Christian world today, both in beliefs and practices. Knowing what primitive Christianity was, and primitive, it doesn't mean crude, it doesn't mean inaccurate, it doesn't mean undeveloped, per se, we would tend to think of it. It's just simply boiled down to its basic nature, its basic elements. The things that were truly taught by Jesus Christ and the apostles. And where do we find accounts of where the apostles went? They went all over the world. Jesus told them to go all over the world. Where did they go? Do we know? There's a few that we know about. But it's not written of. We read of Paul's missionary journeys in the New Testament, largely because he wrote many of them himself. But the others, we don't have that. Where did they go? And why was it not widely reported in church history. I pose to you, it's because Jesus really didn't want all of that information out there. Because if they had it, it would have focused the persecutions better. Things were kept from the world in general. And this subject particularly, of the Davidic line in Britain. People know about that, but in the world in general does not have any clue about the British monarchy. That not only was in Britain, by the way, but up until the early 20th century, prior to about 1914, all of the royal houses of Europe were related to the British crown. All of them. It's incredible. When it was said that there would never be a man, there would never be the lack of a man to sit upon the throne of Israel, that was a little broader statement than we might think about. Because it was not just one tribe. It was all of the tribes. Think about that. But why does the world not want to know? You would think Christian history would be of interest to Christian people, would it not? They don't want to know. Why do they not want to know? Well, there's important reasons. Number one, it provides identities of the 10 tribes on who Jacob is, because Jacob factors into Bible prophecy in a great deal. Who are these people? Most of the world just thinks Jews, that's all. No. As we saw, the ethnicity is much broader than just the Judaic peoples. There's the other 10 tribes. The world doesn't want to know. They don't really want to know who the 10 tribes are. And what's the problem with that? Well, it's a simple problem. It has to do with God's law. Most Christians will admit, yes, the Jews have to keep God's law because they're Israel. Gentiles don't have to keep God's law. Well, problem with that. You see, there's the other 10 tribes, which are just as much Israel, if not more so, than are the Jews. So if the Jews are obligated to keep God's law, so are the other 10 tribes, just as much. They don't want to know that. It's a little too problematic to think like that. Also, it has to do with the connection with prophecy. Connection with understanding the millennium. The millennial kingdom of God on earth. That was a primitive teaching. It's a New Testament teaching. It's an Old Testament teaching. It's all through the prophets. The millennial kingdom of God, 1,000 years on earth. What does that do to the other idea about what happens when someone dies? See the problem? Some questions they don't want to face. Another thing is to know where God is working in the modern age. Where do you look for God's work? Saudi Arabia? Egypt? Japan? China? Where do you look for God's work? Where is God's work being done in this age? It's among, bad as it is, polluted as it is, apostate as it may be, it's primarily among the peoples of Israel. Who translated the Bible into modern language in a big way? Where did we get our Bible? From which people? Where did the world get its Bible? Granted, some translations exist in other languages. But where did that impetus begin? It was in that same region where primitive Christianity was first introduced. And it was only fairly recently. The early church in Britain did not have the New Testament. They didn't have a Bible as we know it. They may have had the Old Testament, probably at least in Greek, eventually in Latin, but did they have it in their native tongue? Not so much until the early 1600s. So what we can know from discovering primitive Christianity as it existed in Britain in the first 300 or 400 years is a means of identifying the true biblical religion, the faith as it was once delivered. Because the faith that we see today is a faith that has been seriously compromised, seriously polluted, seriously apostatized by other religious factors. The Roman Church is infiltrated by Mithraism, Marcionism, Zoroastrianism. There's many components in Zoroastrianism that are so comparable to the Christian religion today, you wonder, how did they get there? Where did they get their ideas? Did Christianity borrow its ideas from the Zoroastrians, or was there some introduction of the truth to those people in centuries before? There are stories that during this same interval when Jesus was missing from his homeland, that he also traveled to India. Now, India is the very eastern edge of the Parthian Empire. Did Jesus also go through Parthia? What connection would he have had with those people? Now, keep in mind, the elites of Parthia came to his birth. They were seeking him. For what purpose? They said worship. But you see, there was another branch of the Davidic line in Parthia also. Would he have had any interest in that? Any legitimate descendant of David was a potential heir to the Parthian throne. And there's more of that in the message that I gave on this subject. How would he go there as a young man? Now, we know that the Magi, the Parthians, read of that in Acts chapter 1, the Parthians were frequent attendees to the holy days in Jerusalem. Would he have traveled with the elites of Parthia back to their homeland for a time? It's not unreasonable. All of this has to do with his mission. And that could be how some of these so-called Christian ideas got infused into the Parthian religion. It could be just feedback from that interaction. We can't say for sure. It might take a great deal of research to get through to affirm that kind of thing. I'm just posing it as a certainly plausible explanation of why it is that Zoroastrianism contained many of the elements that later became incorporated into the Christian religion. The Christians didn't borrow from paganism to create the religion as we understand it today. It could have been that some of those ideas were salted there long before. Don't forget, the Parthian nation existed for another 220 years after the time of Christ. So there was time for certain ideas to be introduced and to gel and to become known. So the world doesn't want to know The world has no use for such information. It creates too many problems, too many questions. But we can know that God had a plan. It was an underlay of all that was going on throughout history. God had a plan for taking his message to the world through all time. And the instruments he used were not necessarily all perfect. I'm not saying the British religion today or even back into the 400 or 500s AD. I'm not saying it was anywhere near perfect. It too could have modified over time. I'm just saying it became the environment where true Christianity, primitive Christianity, could thrive for at least a time to get established before the rest of Christian development took place. But it's interesting to know that God had a plan. He was ever mindful of his covenant. He knew where his own personal destiny lied, there in the Davidic line that was established in some of the most obscure and indirect ways that we could ever imagine. But it was essential for his plan. The peoples of Israel, poorly done as it may be, the peoples of Israel were intended to convey God's truth to the world throughout history. And that's what this little episode, I think, had a great deal to do with. There's a lot of information that could be presented on this kind of thing. I sort of hit the highlights. But hopefully it gives you enough of the picture to realize what to look for. The faith once delivered, where do we find it? What does it look like? How is it practiced? That's what we need to follow up on.